Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Riley Herbst from 2311 Racing here, and you know what grinds my gears? Waiting for coffee. But instead of counting frappes and lattes, I fire up Chumba Casino. No apps, no fuss, just fun social casino games to pass the time. By the time my coffee's ready,
order for Riley.
I've already taken a few victory laps. Next time you're stuck waiting, make it entertaining. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
This is David Marler, UFO researcher, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined here for a little bonus episode this week. And I say bonus because this was arranged pretty hastily in the last couple of hours. My guest, let's just get him straight on. If you have listened to the podcast for a while, I imagine you'll be familiar. But if not, he is one of, if not the best UFO historian in the world. And I don't say that lightly. He'll hate me saying that, but I do believe that. Only because I don't know many of them. But yeah, for me, he is the best. So Mr. Graham Rendell, welcome back, Graham.
Hello, Andy. Thanks for having us on again. Thank you.
Very good to have you on. And like I say, this is proper lastminute.com, isn't it, in terms of interviews?
Yeah, I could check the timestamp when we first decided to do this. I think it was like 3 o'clock this afternoon, like 12 o'clock at lunchtime.
Yeah, it was about lunchtime. Yeah, but we're texting at lunchtime, and I was like, oh, do you know what? I could get you on because I've got so many interviews planned in for this week. I thought, why not just give myself another 45 minutes or hour less time to do. But no, it was really interesting because, Graham, you, of course, now are not only a distinguished author of over 12,000 books, I say that flippantly, of many, many books, not only on the UFO topic, but aviation and whatnot, because you're a big aviation buff. But you've written many historically wonderfully researched books on the UFO topic, and we'll talk about those in a second, get a bit of a recap. But you've now got your own YouTube channel, Bite-Sized UFOs, and I would encourage folks to go and check that out. I'll put the link in the description. Take a second just now to even do that and click in and make sure you subscribe to Graham's channel, because in terms of the history of this topic, you won't find anything more factually accurate, better researched, or just well presented than what Graham's doing just now. And that's not to disparage other people, but you'll see that with the work Graham puts in. So definitely check out his channel. But Graham, if folks right now are tuning in and thinking, who is this handsome young gentleman Andy's talking to there? That's especially if they're watching on video. But either way, who are you, Graham, and why am I talking to you?
Well, let's put it this way. I live about 40 miles from you. So I live in the north of England. I have been interested in UFOs since my mother bought me a book on the subject when I was about 8 or 9. So that was nearly 50 years ago. I'm not that handsome a gentleman. I've got a face for radio and barely that. But yeah, I've been interested in it for decades. I've only in the last few years since I took early retirement been able to, you know, put pen to paper as such and come up with these books that you were talking about before. But I guess it's just basically that when I was a kid and I was reading these books and there was a lack of source information, a lack of detail, and I vowed that if I ever got to the point where I could actually write a book myself on the subject, that's what I would do. I'd go into great detail and I would put where I got my sources. So hopefully that goes some way to make people interested in what I write. So yeah, that's all I can do. And if people like them and buy them, that's great. If they don't, equally, that's fine. You know, it's free will.
Yeah, and I say flippantly 12,000 books, but Graham, you do churn out a fair number of books. I don't think it's a secret that you're retired from active work, you know, or is that a secret and I should delete that from the podcast?
No, it's not. I took early retirement before I was even officially allowed to from the NHS some years ago, and I basically just survived by writing and making money from writing. So, and I'm a full-time author now, so I'm self-employed. So yes, that's what I do 24/7. And obviously when I'm taking a break from writing or researching, then as you mentioned before, the Bite-Sized UFOs YouTube channel is a kind of a latest project, but it's quite nice because it dovetails into everything else I'm doing. So all the research I'm doing for the books, and obviously I'm sometimes lifting information from the books I've already written, which is quite convenient because it's quite a nice source of material just for another YouTube video. But also I feel I can expand a little bit in terms of the visual aspect, you know, from the book, because you can't like shoehorn a book full of pictures. And obviously, as we know, I've had run-ins with Amazon about pictures in my books. So the YouTube channel is probably the better way to get that out to the public.
Yeah, and you can't really plagiarize yourself, can you? So it's a really good way of getting that work out in a different format, a different medium, which I definitely appreciate. And behind me, if folks are on YouTube, Graham, some of those books just to touch on, because we've done probably three interviews or something at least on your books and the podcast in the past. But we've got, you know, Flying Saucer Fever, UFOs Before Roswell, which we'll get to because that is now the name of the documentary, and I've got another couple of your books behind us on the other side of me that people can't quite see. But why is the history of the subject something you stick to so rigorously? Because what we don't have is UFOs 2017 to 2020.
Well, I'm not there yet. Give me a chance. I think, like, you know, it doesn't matter what subject you look at. If it's something that's lasted for quite a long time, then actually history, the history of whatever that is, will teach you a lot about what's happening, you know, in the present. So I always think the history is important. Doesn't matter what you're looking at. And the things that happened in the past, actually, they're sort of happening now in some ways, because we've got a new round of investigations. We've got a new round of people who are interested in it. But this has all happened before. We've had official investigations into UFOs. And you know, for whatever reason, they ended up with nothing really tangible. And we're not sure whether the recent current stuff is going to go the same way. You just have to look at Arrow and all the trials and tribulations there to find out it doesn't really amount to much at the moment. They're saying that there's nothing to see. Well, we've been down that road already. So, you know, looking back, you're looking forward as well, because you're actually seeing what happened beforehand, and it gives you a much kind of a better appreciation of what's happening now. So that's why I think history is important. But also, people come to the subject from 2017 onwards, you know, all the new crop of people who are now interested in UFOs because of those three videos and everything that's happened since then, that they've got this huge, you know, kind of like group of sightings, or this raft of sightings that have happened over 8 decades now, that they've probably got no idea about. Or if they have, they only know like the high spots like Roswell and Kenneth Arnold and a few others. But there's a whole lot of stuff as well apart from that, which just, you know, builds up to a huge picture about what's been happening.
We'll finish up on the podcast talking about the NOW and the UAP Disclosure Act and just get a little bit of chat on that to finish up. But before then, so Bite-Sized UFOs, you've decided to do this documentary, UFOs Before Roswell, World War II UFO Sightings Over Europe, Part 1 and 2. Graham, just to address this, because we literally spoke about it just before we hit record, I looked at you and said, part two is only 11 minutes long, whereas part one's over 2 hours. Do you want to just clear that one up straight away?
Yeah,
for anyone who even may have watched part one already, Graham?
I'm quite a novice when it comes to YouTube, so I wasn't aware that there was a 256 gigabyte limit for uploading videos. And the one I've done, I mean, I thought it was just one part. And I've seen videos on YouTube before which are well into 3 hours. So I thought doing a 2-hour 30 video would upload in one piece. And then when it came to the premiere, we were watching it on Sunday night with all the people who were tuned in, it cut off at 2:05, which was like really strange. Thing, what's going on? And this, you know, it's all there on the video that I uploaded. And it turns out that's the limit. So it just cuts it off. So I had to do some frantic kind of re-editing of the video and create a new file just for those little extra 11 minutes. And then obviously have a little box that comes up at the end of the YouTube video at the end of part one, at one of the chapter breaks, and say, right, you know, click on this and you can see your part two. So yeah, unfortunately it's split into two bits, but it's only a click away. So, you know, when you get to that point, 2 hours and 5 minutes in, the last 11 minutes, 12 minutes, which are basically the 1945 sightings and a wrap-up of the documentary at the end, you know, don't forget to watch that as well, please.
Absolutely. And I might say it on the tin, Graham, but let's ask the obvious question here. What is the documentary about? And don't say UFOs before Roswell.
It's effectively what I wrote in the book of that name, but it's looking at a little bit more than what's in the book, because as you know, and some people out there know, I'm working on a sequel to UFOs Before Roswell. So some of the stuff that's going to end up in that book, whenever that does come out, and it's not going to be this year by the looks of things, I'm not writing that quick now. I'm pacing myself now, if you like. I'm getting older. So some of the stuff that's going to appear in that book is also in the documentary, because you know, it was either stuff I didn't know about or I hadn't researched enough to put it in the first book. So this documentary is a bit of a mishmash between the old book and hopefully the new book. So there's a lot of stuff that in the documentary that people probably don't know about, and they certainly haven't read from, you know, from my side of things before. So hopefully a lot of it's still new, or even the people who have read the book, UFOs Before Roswell, will find some stuff in there which they've never seen before. And you know, if anything, the pictures are quite nice. So hopefully they'll get a rise out of that.
Let's address an elephant in the room that we messaged about earlier, and we've not actually spoke about since. You're not James Fox, right? I think, and that's not the elephant in the room. People should realise that. You don't have decades of documentary making experience behind you. Nope. You don't have a budget. You don't have editing software and all that kind of stuff. This is your first go at this sort of feature-length documentary, and whether people want to see it as your bite-sized UFO project, you've got kind of 10, 11, 15-minute clips of a particular case. It's presented this way. This is like one of those strung out, but with loads of events and, you know, context and research put into it. So you don't have budgets for voiceovers. I was too expensive for you. You didn't even ask me. But you've used AI, haven't you, for the voiceover? And I had to ask you, is that AI or have you paid for a voiceover? I thought the narration was pretty decent. I wondered if there was something to it. But I think that's an important one to address, because you're going to get people listening going, is this a computer? Why isn't it Graham? Who's voicing it? So do you want to talk about the reasoning behind that and everything?
Oh, yeah, sure. No, it's fine. It's my voice, I mean, at the moment, I sound fine, but I think over a few hours, I have kind of fits and starts with my voice. Sometimes it'll include little bits and it'll be a bit raspy, or there'll be, you know, the usual kind of breathing stuff, because I'm not trained to speak on camera. So I find that I have to edit a lot when I speak. All this kind of stuff, and you have to edit all that out. And I use DaVinci, which is quite a really good free video editing program for the sound and to cut bits out, but it's just really, really painstaking. It takes a long time to do it, and even just for that 10, 15, sometimes 20 minute video that you mentioned before, it can take me hours to, like, you know, just to tune it, whereas this is 2.5 hours. I'll be on forever. I'll never get it out. And actually, I just get, you know, get incredibly frustrated with it. It's bad enough those small bits I do for the normal bite-sized UFO channel videos to do it, to actually get that finished and looking reasonably polished, whereas this would have just been beyond me. So it was easier to do it with an AI program. And the package that I used is quite good, because it has voices in different languages, but also different accents in different countries. And the one I used was Canadian, funny enough, for the main narration. And actually, the name of the voice was Ryan, would you believe. It's not our friend Ryan Sprague, because he's American. But it sounded really good, and I liked it. Now, I understand that's not everybody's cup of tea, and I've already had a few messages saying, you know, I can't watch this because it's AI generated. Okay, that's fair enough. You know, that's your choice. And if you don't like it, that's great, you know, because, you know, you want to listen to proper voiceovers. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to do it this way. For me, that was a personal choice, and, you know, I'll have to live with that. And if you don't want to watch it, then fair enough. you know, that's all I can say. But if you do, if people do have the patience to watch it and listen to the AI voices, they're not bad. They're much better than they used to be. So, you know, I'm quite happy with the finished project. I can't really please everybody all the time, I'm afraid, Andy.
No, and genuinely, again, not just saying this because you're a friend, because you know I'm very honest and I'd be the first one to go, mate, that was a hard listen. The fact that you've got multiple voices, different accents, so when it's splicing between someone discussing their own sighting or a clip or a piece of, you know, a quote from whatever it may be, you get the accents, you get different voices, you're dipping in and out of it. And yeah, I had no issue at all with it. Little smirk now and again when it was, you know, for example, they try and say it's, you know, 5:30, or I think one of them was like 1:30, and they go 1:30. And it's like, that's the very small bits, but it's pretty decent. And I'm worried for my own future, given the quality podcast people could be producing using these AI voices, Graham.
Well, I tried, there was one point where I had to use a Scots accent, and really I was torn between getting you to sound like an AI voice or to use the one on there. It's funny though, because you do have to sometimes tweak the text to make it sound like the word it's going to say, especially if it's a place name, because even the AIs won't say it the right way. So you still have to muck about with it to get it to sound like it should. So there is some work involved there as well. So actually, you know, if I just left it alone and straight off my script, if you like, and had it as, you know, read out as written, it wouldn't have sounded anywhere like it does. So there is a bit of work involved in that as well. So it's not just throwing the script at an AI and saying, oh, get on with it. You know, I've had to tweak it as well. So there's work involved, but you're right to start with. I am no James Fox, nor do I ever aspire to be. This is nowhere on, you know, if people are expecting some bells and whistles documentary on the scale of The Phenomenon or The Program or Moment of Contact, then really, sorry, I'm going to disappoint you. But hopefully you'll still find it interesting nonetheless.
Absolutely. Now let's get back to talking UFOs, Graham. So you've got... For me, straight away, I felt it was like a live version of the books, is like what you've said as well. We're looking at early sightings. It starts off with around the time of early invasions for World War II. That's where we kind of kick off. Time scales and history is terrible. So can you kind of introduce the beginning of the documentary?
Yeah, okay. So this is even going back to before the Battle of Britain, which started in June 1940. So we're still looking at when the Germans are invading the likes of Belgium and France. So we're going back to March, April, May 1940, when the first inklings of things which are out of the ordinary, so lights that follow bombers, UFOs which are seen over cities in Belgium, this kind of thing, that's the start of the video. And then it moves on to some of the other sightings which happened in the likes of, you know, 41, 42, and as the war years went on. So yeah, it starts off really early, which is well before, when people think of World War II sightings, they immediately think of the Foo Fighters. And of course, that was a name which was coined in November 1944. But actually, you know, there are a lot of things which happened much earlier than that, and not just to the American side of the battle, if you like, during the battles during the war. It was a much more kind of British orientated in terms of the sightings much earlier in the war. So yeah, it's important to cover that stuff as well, just so you get a kind of a thorough grounding in what happened during World War II.
For anyone unfamiliar, and obviously the Foo Fighters these days, it's Dave Grohl's band, which that's where he got the name. So, you know, Foo Fighters is where he got it from. But why is it called a Foo Fighter?
That was a name that came from a comic strip that one of the first of the American night fighter crews that started seeing these wave of sightings in November 1944. Actually, as the documentary says, it was earlier when they started seeing them, but that splitting hairs. He was an avid comic book reader. He read a comic strip called Smokey Stover, which is a cartoon fireman who had a fire engine called the Foo-mobile. And of course, that was a play on the French word for fire, which is Foo, F-E-U. But it was obviously Americanized into F-O-O. There's one bit where actually in the comic, I believe it is the Foo Fighter. And this radar operator, he was called Donald Myers, and he came up with this name, Foo Fighter, from that. And as the story goes, after a sighting, he went into the intelligence officer's room on the base where they were stationed, and he slammed the comic book down on the intelligence officer's desk and went, "It's another one of those Foo Fighters." So there you go. So didn't why even really are we not it out either?
No, thanks for the self-editing. I'd have left it in. But why at this time, Graham, aren't we talking UFOs? You know, what's in the lexicon? What's the language to describe? Would people have been able to talk about, you know, if me and you met in the street, would we be discussing sci-fi and talking UFOs? No flying saucers yet, because Kenneth Arnold's still some time away, but what was the kind of language at the time?
I mean, there were, some people were aware of science fiction because it was a thing before World War II. So, you know, there were stories out there that people could read, but it wasn't widespread. And certainly the things about, you know, extraterrestrials, alien civilizations, flying saucers, UFOs, stuff like that wasn't widespread either. So it wasn't in people's, you know, on people's radar. It wasn't in the lexicon back then. So it wasn't on conversations. And when people saw these things during World War II, they were genuinely, you know, surprised, intrigued, amazed. Just didn't know what they were. And of course, when it was looking from a wartime angle, from a kind of military angle, these things were assumed to be the other side's weapons, some kind of new technology, some kind of new breakthrough in whatever, whether it was radar or aircraft or missiles, that kind of thing. And you can see the terminology used in the reports when they're discussing some of this, these phenomena. And actually, they do call them phenomena. It's one of the paragraph title in the intelligence reports. And they call them, first of all, well, lights, and then rockets, and then jets. But then you need a little bit of knowledge about the history of World War II and the weapon systems and when they come into use and where they're used and by who and why, all this kind of stuff to build up a picture of, well, this is, they couldn't have been these things that people say they are, because they weren't, you know, these things weren't used at either the time or the place where these Foo Fighters, lights, rockets, et cetera, were seen, you know, because it was too early in the war or because it was the wrong place, et cetera, et cetera. So this is where you can rule out certain things that have been suggested in the past for, you know, for the cause of the Foo Fighter sightings, et cetera, and the UFO sightings during World War II. But if you go into the records and you're a bit of a historian and a bit of a military World War II buff like I am, this is when you can work out, well, no, that can't be the case.
Some of those descriptions, so like two upturned plates, I'm guessing would be the flying saucer description, and you can just think of two dinner plates, one on top of the other. Yeah,
that's right. And of course, this was a description that was effectively, you know, was that somebody had made long before Kenneth Arnold saw his, you know, flying saucers in 47. And before that kind of description became a, not a regular, but a certain, you know, every so often people would say that's what it looked like. You know, from some of the sightings in the late 40s and early 50s. So, yeah, things that happened in World War II seemed to be a kind of precursor to what was going to happen a few years later.
You mentioned like the phenomena word being used in reports early on, and I remember it was back a few years ago you were telling me, and I'm sure you weren't the first person to discover this, but I heard it from you, UAP was used way back before the last couple of years, where people think unidentified aerial phenomena as an acronym is new, and it's not, is it?
1949, I think, is the first recorded use of that particular phrase, and certainly in a document. And then you see unidentified phenomenon as well, or unidentified aircraft, unidentified. There's all kind of variations on the theme, if you like. So it is something that it almost, you know, it's come around again. It's come around full circle. So this is going back to what I said before about, you know, history. You see this kind of thing, you know, sort of happen again and again.
There was another term I heard, and it was one of the guys in the military. I never went back to it, Graham, because I was just trying to power through it. Was it Lundin's Lights, or one of the gentlemen who reported seeing these
Lundin's
things?
Lights. It was a New Zealand fighter pilot from December 1942. It was a Hurricane pilot on a night intruder mission over France, and he'd seen two lights. Now, the thing is, if you see two lights at night, you probably think the navigation lights, you know, the wingtip lights on an airplane. But in this case, they were at an angle, so one was higher than the other, and they followed him for 15 minutes or so at this kind of strange, on this kind of, this strange orientation. So if that had been, you know, the pilot of an aircraft, why was he flying lopsided like this, you know, for 15 minutes? It just seemed very strange.
Something that kind of got the theme that was coming up within these observations that you're making are a lot of reports, especially from those kind of war times, are of the objects observing only. Now, bear in mind, it's a battlefield, and these things are being seen where, you know, pilots are shooting each other and all these kinds of aircraft, and pretty horrible time. So It's one thing seeing a UFO now, or like the Tic Tac event, they weren't actively shooting at each other. They weren't engaging Russian and Chinese troops. You know, it wasn't that sort of area. So you can see these things are just observing, but in an active military zone, it still seemed to be these things are just observing. So is it fair to say, and Graham, famously, you're hard to kind of draw blood from a stone when it comes to some of this conversation, but these things are almost definitely some kind of reconnaissance craft or object.
You could infer that from some of the, you know, from the details of some of these sightings that in, I mean, it's not something I include in the documentary, but there are stories of some of these lights following aircraft for up to 250 miles. Now, no self-respecting German night fighter pilot would trail an aircraft that long without having a go at it. You know, kind of thing. You wouldn't follow an aircraft to its target and then follow it back again. What would be the point? The idea of the German night fighter for the Nachtjag was to actually shoot down enemy bombers so that they didn't drop bombs in their cities, on their factories, on their airfields. So it was pointless, this kind of exercise, but this happened. So if something is trailing an aircraft, it's got it under observation. So that bit's right, I would have thought, is right. You know, I'm agreeing with you there. And then it might be just curiosity. And of course, you know, who knows what the kind of motivation from whatever these things were, whether it was, or whether it was just some kind of, I don't know, kind of drone, or whether it was some, you know, some way of going back in history and looking at what a famous battle. You know, you can kind of come up with any kind of scenario to explain what's happening. The upshot is we simply don't know what, you know, what and why. But we do know that these things happen because it's in the records.
You said before that a lot of the thinking was that these were enemy craft, jets, fighters, whatever it may be. But things like you've just said, they are being trailed for 250 miles with no attempt to engage, seems really odd. So was there thinking that this was a something else, but they didn't know what it was? Or was it just down to, it must have been the enemy, but they didn't engage us?
They have this struggle. There's about a two-year period between 40 and 42 when they regularly compile lists or numbers, you know, and figures about these lights that follow the aeroplanes. And they can't work it out why there's no real attacks resulting, and why they can't identify the aeroplanes, you know, that supposedly carry these lights. So it's just that it ends up that they're just lights. And later in the war, they see these things, these lights, and they're zigzagging towards the bombers. As in they're under kind of some kind of either manual control or radio control. And that's what they suspect. So they think there's some kind of missile or some kind of flak rocket that's chasing after the bomber. But in all the cases, they don't hit the bombers. They just follow them and then fly off again. So if they are some kind of German rocket or missile, then it's not known in the histories of these programs, because nothing like that, you know, ever shows up in what's known about all this stuff. The night fighter pilots, they, when you read the books about, you know, their histories, whether they've written them or somebody else has written them about them, there's never any you know, mention of use of like searchlights or any other types of lights to track bombers or follow bombers or for extended periods of time or distance. So none of it makes any sense. But if you then look at it from a UFO angle, once we've got the benefit of hindsight, that's when things make a little bit more sense. And when you match them against other things which happened, you know, in the late 40s and early 50s and in the 60s, etc., you know, when you see lights that follow aircraft or etc., or some of the shapes of some of the things. Now we're seeing Tic Tacs. Back then they were called torpedo-shaped objects or zeppelins or airships, even in some of the reports, and some of those feature in the documentary. Then, you know, you can see the kind of the similarities between then and now. It's one of these things again, you know, things just come full circle.
So I'm thinking back, we're talking World War II, and thinking back to the history lessons I had in school and the limited knowledge I have, Graham, a lot of young servicemen were taken away with limited education to fight in wars with craft and with weaponry and systems they were probably unfamiliar with, and were given a bit of a crash course in just to get them up and fighting in numbers. Is that fair to say?
It would be, yeah. If you're talking about bomber crew, so a lot by mid-war period, they were starting to use somewhat for the time sophisticated electronic gear. So the first airborne radar for night fighter crews, you got the first bombing aids, so things that could actually drop bombs on targets even though they couldn't see them. So, you know, blind bombing aids, as we'll call it. The Germans were using those in 1940, but we used them a bit later on the war. There was all the kind of jamming stuff to defeat night fighter radar. There was stuff that picked up the telltale emissions from radars on other aircraft. All this kind of stuff they had to learn how to use. So there was this thorough training given on everything. And then, of course, you had aircraft recognition courses, so people could recognize aircraft, whether it was in the dark or in the light. And all this kind of stuff. And of course, just the basic stuff like flying heavy bombers, that took a lot of training as well. Operating gun turrets, navigation, radio, operating, all that stuff was, intensive courses. Air gunners used to go sit through like a 13-week course just to become an air gunner, to sit in an aircraft for 7 or 8 hours at a time and swivel a gun turret around and open fire an aircraft. So it was a lot of work done just to get these guys into a plane, to send them over Germany to drop the bombs on targets.
It makes me think, though, if I'm going to be skeptical, that you've got a lot of folks who are still relatively inexperienced, or far less experienced than the RAF would have hoped, for example, in what they were going to do. Could just that sheer heightened state of alert, that anxiety, what sort of percentage of those reports do you think are just misidentifications by inexperienced personnel?
I'll go back to something that's actually in the documentary. So you, from what you're saying there, that actually refers to a report or part of an intelligence report from 1940, where they talk about 92 separate sightings of these lights. And they reckon that in some of them, they're probably just planets. If the aircraft moves violently, then something moves as well in terms of a star or a planet. And if a gunner or a, whoever in the crew sees this, because they're in this kind of like perpetual state of, sort of awareness that they might be shot at any minute by a night fighter coming up behind them, then they're going to automatically assume that that's something moving like an airplane, because it's a bright light or, moving very, very violently. And it does actually mention this in the intelligence report, that they're not entirely sure of the validity of all the sightings. Now, that's effectively an early form of the stigma that affected some of the US air crew back in the 40s and 50s, when they were accused of seeing things when they were reporting UFOs. These guys might not always been highly educated, but by the time they got to the point where they were flying in these bombers or night fighters, they were educated in the disciplines that they were trained to do. And if you flew enough missions, then you became really, really clued up very quickly. Otherwise, you ended up dead.
Yeah, no, that's fair. You talk about these things are tailing people and they're observing and they're never engaging. They would zigzag, they were just lights. But are there reports of anything like an engagement happening or craft being downed because of these?
Not craft being downed as such. There are a couple of stories of things bursting into flames when they hit them, when they're not sure what these things are. But there's two or three stories where the fighter pilots do actually open fire at these objects or these lights. And both those stories happened in 1943, one off North Africa and the other one in southern Italy. And then there's, of course, the story which is portrayed by Dan and Olaf on the front of UFOs Before Roswell, the book, which is of the bomber crew over Holland in March 1942, where they fired an amber light that basically goes around their airplane, sits off the tail, then sits off the wing, and then sits off the nose. And it seems to be impervious to machine gun fire. The light that was seen in North Africa that was fired on by a Hurricane, a night intruder pilot, he opened up this thing with 20mm cannon, which were designed to rip open like thin armor on armored personnel carriers and soft skin vehicles. So that should have really devastated anything it hit, whereas the light just shrugged it off and just kept following the aircraft. And then there's another case where the pilot doesn't open fire at it off southern Italy, but he does chase it round circles, a bit like the Tic Tac incident from 2004, where they're going round circles trying to get on each other's tail. But this thing just basically outflies the aeroplane and just zooms off upwards and out of sight. So this is a kind of almost a prototypical you know, sort of a Nimitz encounter, if you like, albeit the speeds are much less, but you can see the kind of, you know, the difference between the aircraft at the time and what these lights can do. And a lot of the stories of the Foo Fighters as well, these lights just zip off into the distance once they've, you know, they've carried out whatever kind of surveillance of the aircraft and their witnesses, and then they just disappear off into the sunset kind of thing.
There's a lot of cases discussed and events discussed and encounters discussed in the documentary. Like I say, it's 2 hours, 20 minutes, 2 hours, 30 minutes. But I did smile, Graham, when I heard, and I mentioned before we recorded, January 2nd, 1944, Northumberland. And I say that because that's where I live. Okay, so that's about as close as I'm going to tell people. I live in the northeast of England. I still get messages from folks who think I live in Scotland, but I don't anymore, folks. I'm in the northeast of England, in Northumberland. So this was kind of my area. And do you want to talk about that particular sighting, Graham, and what happened then?
Okay. So I live down in County Durham now, which is just south of you. I used to live 12 miles from where this used to happen. So I lived a bit further north from you in Northumberland a few years ago. And this is over the town of Alnwick, which is a market town sort of up towards the Scottish border. And yeah, January 1944, a Spitfire reconnaissance pilot, he was RAF, he belonged to Coastal Command, and he was in a training, it was a part of a training unit, it was called Warrant Officer Able, and he was flying north towards Aberdeen, where the unit was based, and flying over Alnwick, 22,000 feet, he sees four black rectangle-shaped objects, and he says they're stationary in midair. And this sighting, there's no more details of the actual sighting, but the information is passed to the local fighter command headquarters, which were based in Newcastle. That was the head of a 13 group. That was Blakelaw in Newcastle, where they were based. Now, unfortunately, that again, well, like a lot of these stories, that's where the trail goes cold. And nobody yet, as far as I'm aware, has actually found out any other kind of document to say that was passed up the chain of command, whether it was looked at, etc., or whether there were any others. But I don't think anybody's really delved into the fighter command operational research section files yet. And I have got those on my list next time I go down to the National Archives to see whether there's any follow-up to this. I first read of this story, funnily enough, in John Hanson's book. He was a retired police officer who used to write a lot about British cases. And in his book, it mentions they were triangles. Now, I've looked at the records. I found the actual reference to them in the National Archives files for this particular Air Force unit, and it does mention rectangles. So they weren't triangular; they were actually rectangles. So I've got the proper story. It's just trying to find out, you know, what happened to the information afterwards. It's like a lot of other cases in World War II where bomber crews or fighter crews saw these strange objects, and the information, we do have a paper trail that says they were passed up the chain of command so far, but when they get to headquarters, bomber command or fighter command, there's no more, you know, kind of talk of them. So we don't really know what happened to these reports, you know, how much they were analyzed in depth afterwards, and who looked at them as well.
From your research, all the work you've done so far, Graham, particularly around those kind of time periods, what is the most rational explanation for this explosion in sightings of Foo Fighters, orbs, light craft, whatever people want to call them, around these kind of, around the planet, to be fair, isn't there? You've mentioned North Africa, the US, the UK. So what's the most rational explanation?
I think the main thing is because you mentioned before about, you know, there's a load of people now and that they're not that educated, but actually it's just the fact that there's loads of people. So, and they're now trained observers because, you know, they're on guard duty or they're in airplanes looking for other airplanes trying to shoot them down. So you've got these highly motivated, highly trained observers who are keenly looking out to their own surroundings. And they're always on the watch for something that looks out of the ordinary, because if it is out of the ordinary, chances are it's the enemy trying to sneak up on you somehow, whether it's on the ground or on the sea or in the air. So they're motivated to look for things out of the ordinary and to report them. And then there's also this kind of back office function who investigate reports of strange things, because it's usually enemy technology. And of course, that was the case through World War II. You only have to look at the kind of cat and mouse that the Germans and the British were doing in terms of airborne and electronic warfare, which had its pretty much its infancy during World War II, and also in the history of radar as well, and countermeasures for radar. So you have this kind of, you know, this thing in the background where people are looking at that information that they're getting from the front line and trying to work out what the other side are doing. The Germans would be doing that to us as well. We would certainly do it to reports of what they people were seeing about what they had. Now, in the middle of all this, there's all this strange stuff that's appearing, which doesn't fit the profile, and that's the stuff I'm interested in. I can't reconcile it against any of the known technology, whether it was on a drawing board somewhere, or it was in prototype stage, or whether it was actually in operational service. And I'm not the only one that's looked at that, of course. There are people before me who did as well, and they come up with the fact that, you know, they scratch their head as well. And I'm just the latest person to do that. I'm just doing it in more detail, I guess. And funny enough, Keith Chester, who wrote the 2007 book Strange Company, which I guess is like a smaller version of UFOs before Roswell, it was the book that one of the things that inspired me to come up with this book as well. And I'm friends with Keith. I do actually contact him every so often. And, you know, he didn't come up with an answer either. So, and there's people who investigated Foo Fighters back in the 1990s, people like Andy Roberts and Jeff Linsell in America. And they, you know, didn't really come up with an answer either. So yeah, we're all still scratching our heads here, but like everybody else in ufology, you know, if we had the answers, then we wouldn't have a need for your program or my books or you know, James Fox's documentaries, now, would we?
I think if we had some of the, do you know, this is funny, slight sidebar, James Fox on with Jesse Michaels, American Alchemy, had just said in his interview that's just aired a couple of days ago that he doesn't think in his lifetime he'll get all the answers.
Yeah.
I don't think most folk at this point are looking for all the answers, really. What we're looking for is a confirmation officially of, are we alone, yes or no? And a lot of people, we can all go right now, you know, we're not alone. People involved in this topic to various degrees have different experiences or levels of sightings or research, you know, history. But I think that official no, we're not alone, then spawns a whole load more answers. And for me, that I get asked quite often, you know, if we found out tomorrow UFOs are real, would you stop doing the podcast? And I'm like, well, definitely not. Like, that's when
you got more material then, don't you? So you can then dive into more. Yeah,
there's so many more questions. And I wonder from your point of view then, to wrap up this section, Graham, and finish on a few listener questions, like, what for you is the importance of people watching not just this documentary or just reading your books, but caring about the history of the topic when so many folks focus on the here and now? What's so important about the history when it was so long ago?
I think it is simply the fact that ufology, UFO sightings are quite long lived. You know, it's things like 8 decades is the modern day phenomenon, if you like. People say, oh, it started in 1947. Well, actually, no, it didn't. There were these tons of sightings that happened just a few years earlier. But I think those 8 decades from the, you know, beginning of the 1940s right through to the present, I think they're important to have in context. It's not just a current thing. It is a long-running thing, and that's why it's more important than people just saying, what's happening now? It's not just the Nimitz encounters. It's not just the stuff that happened in 2015 off the eastern coast, west coast of America. It's not the U.S. Navy sightings of 2019, etc. There's all this rich kind of, you know, sort of history of what happened. Not just in the 70s with the nuclear missile silos getting shut down, not just the 60s with the likes of, you know, Lonnie Zamora at Socorro, not just the 50s with the Washington weekends. You know, you go back to this, you know, Roswell, to Kenneth Arnold, and then to the wartime sightings. It's a huge, huge issue. And, you know, rather than just try and confront people like lawmakers and media personalities with, oh, we need to talk about UFOs because it's all happening now, you also have to hit them with this huge, rich history, because that makes it much more important, much more rounded, you know, much more of a phenomenon than just a few things that happened recently. And I think that's why it's important that we also talk about it and we don't forget it as well.
Yeah, very good answer. Chase had a question around that, Graham. So revisiting the Foo Fighter aspect using today's modern UAP lens, does anything stand out to you that we have so much more evidence around orbs, sightings increasing, decreasing? How do you see that kind of... I suppose orbs are the fairest one to use these days, aren't they, in terms of Foo Fighters?
How do you equate that? Yeah, and I have difficulty trying to kind of separate the two. And But also the way I think that some people view orbs nowadays, which are things that enter people's houses sometimes, or the same, you know. So I'm not sure what, I can't speak with any authority on what that side of the kind of phenomenon represents. All I would say is that the Foo Fighters were lights. That's what they were reported. There were the same sort of things that were reported in the late 40s and early 50s over Korea as well. A lot of the Far Eastern Air Force reports of the time, you know, are just lights in the sky. And then you get those right through the 50s and beyond. So I don't think that phenomenon went away. I think they were just called different names. So it all depends on how many people are looking at it from a certain place at a certain time as to how many reports you get. So I don't think, you know, there's anything new under the sun. But in terms of orbs, if that's what people are calling them nowadays, then fair enough. It's just it's a new name. Similarly, like the torpedo-shaped objects that were seen in the 40s, and some of them appear in the documentary, they're now called Tic Tacs. Back then, they were called torpedoes or airships. In the 50s, they were called cigar-shaped objects. So, you know, people call them different things, different times, but essentially, they seem to be the same kind of thing.
Is there anything you've seen within that, Graham, that has completely gone away or is completely new in terms of phenomenon?
Not really. World War II appears to be a microcosm in terms of reports, as compared to what came afterwards. So you have lights in the sky, you have objects which are, you know, strange in nature in terms of shape, but also in the way they maneuver and the speeds involved. You also have a few contact cases where people, witnesses, have seen what they claim to be, you know, beings, occupants of craft, which have landed. So everything that you see afterwards, it happened in World War II, but on a much smaller scale in terms of the contact cases. But everything else, yeah, you get them as well. I think the only thing that there isn't, or at least there's no firm kind of evidence or even documentation for, are crashes. But then, of course, you've got that Italian, you know, sort of thing from much earlier, from 10 years earlier, that may or may not be true. So, you do have around that period, there are some stories at least.
Do you think when you mention crashes or the lack of those kind of stories, given at that time there would have been, tell me the number here, Graham, but how many thousand aircraft crashed or were damaged and landed in the water, on land? And if something saucer-like did crash and land, would it have been quite easy to ignore it, miss it, or dismiss it as a downed aircraft?
No, I think it's hard to tell because you don't know what they look like when you're close up. I mean, nobody's had a really kind of good explanation of what some of these things actually look like. In terms of the craft, you know, some of them were huge. They were 200, 300 foot long, the ones that were reported. Some were slightly smaller, but quite large. And then other things were described as translucent discs or amber discs. Some were silvery objects. So nobody's got a real hard and fast kind of idea of what they commonly look like. But I guess if something out of the ordinary landed somewhere or crashed somewhere, then people would know it was something different than, say, a propeller-driven fighter or a jet bomber. People pretty much knew what those were. So I think they would have had a pretty good idea if something had washed up somewhere or it had crashed on land. They would have squirreled it away somewhere for further study.
Question from Algo. Graham and Andy, a question to you both. UAP are vehicles of sorts. What do UAP do when they are not in motion? That should amount to a greater portion of their existence. Is there any evidence or accounts of this? How are you taking that question, Graham?
Well, they're not in motion. I mean, just literally, is it what happens when they're standing still? But I guess you can also interpret it as being when we don't see them, what are they doing?
Yeah, which is a wild speculative conversation.
I can't answer. Yeah, I can't answer that particular part of the question. All I would say is that in some reports that the things are stationary when they're seen. So there are stories, you know, those four black triangles that we talked about before, they were stationary. There are reports of silvery balls being seen in Germany by US bomber crews, which apparently were stationary. So in daylight over Germany. So we don't know what those were either. So there are things which, you know, they're not moving. So if you want to take the literal kind of answer to his question, then that's what that is. But, you know, if you want to say, well, what were they doing when they weren't seen? I can't answer that. Who knows is the answer.
Graham, folks, if you're just being introduced to him, doesn't like to speculate too much on the origin of, and I think what may be coming from that algo potentially, and where Graham doesn't want to go, is, are these things in underwater bases, you know, off the coast of the US? Are these things coming from behind the moon? Are they coming from different dimensions? Is it fair to say, Graham, most of these sightings that you report on and research are happening over water?
No, there are some happens over water, but a lot of the reports in let's say the documentary and also in the book were happening over land. Now, there are reports over water, and there are definitely, and there's definitely one covered in the documentary of a huge wingless object that came behind a bomber, which was flying on an anti-submarine patrol over the Bay of Biscay in November 42. There was also another one in the documentary of an aircraft that was flying from Brazil to Africa, and you know, two lights basically came up on it. And flew around it, separated, flew around it, and trailed it for a bit. So things were happening over water as well. And there are, which I haven't covered, stories of ships encountering, you know, strange things in the course of World War II as well. There's a story from 1945, which I think is off Alaska, certainly on the Pacific Ocean anyway. So there are stories from around the world. I mean, the thing we haven't mentioned is that, you know, the Foo Fighter phenomenon and the UFOs in general were seen in the Pacific campaign as well during World War II. It's just not something I'm concentrating on because, being a European, you know, I was much more interested in the European side of things during World War II.
In terms of hypothesis, there was a real struggle as to what these things were outside of, you know, maybe it was a German technology, enemy technology, a misidentification. Was it too much even a stretch then to think that they had any working origin, that these things are coming from the water, these things are coming from land somewhere? Was there even any discussion around that?
Some of the reports suggest that they're not sure whether they're taking off from the ground or close to the ground, especially in the Foo Fighter reports. There's a few where they say it looked like it was coming up off the ground. Now, that would suggest it was some kind of missile that was controlled and could follow a bomber. But then you had these, what they call the T-forces, and that were going through Germany and basically, you know, going through all the industry that they were capturing, going and interviewing people connected with, you know, with research plants and with air, aircraft factories and all the rest of it. You know, the spoils of war kind of thing. They were going through things with a fine tooth comb after the war, even as early as even before the Allied invasion of Normandy in June 44. They'd already set up two an American and a British kind of subcommittees that were saying, this is what we're going to look at when we capture it in Germany after the war. They had lists of factories and research plants and airfields to look at, and they did do it in the reports. You can find them if you look hard enough, whether they're in the National Archives or in the American Archives. You can see these reports and you can see exactly the kind of factories and places they looked through, the people they talked to, the technology they discovered, all this stuff that we're going to use themselves after the war, and nothing in it actually resembles anything that we see the reports of. Even though some people, and they're quite fringe elements, say, well, you know, the Germans were building flying saucers during the war, you know, and they were flying these things and test flying them and flying them against the bombers, or they built things that homed in on aircraft exhausts and, you know, and did damage to them. Well, that's great. You know, they're wonderful stories, but you've got to back them up with a little bit of evidence, even if it's not the full story. And yet you can't find any of this in the archives. And when people refer to it in books that they've written, they try to sell these claims. It's always, well, it's well known that, you know, these kind of, you know, kind of little bits that they include around the stories. Well, that's not evidence. That's just hearsay as far as I'm concerned. And until I find it, then I'm not going to really believe any of it.
Very fair. And I wouldn't expect otherwise of you, Graham. To finish up,
I do.
To finish up, let's bring you screaming and shouting into the here and now, away from your comfort zone of the past. I know you don't like it here. Everything's gone in colour for you. But the UAP Disclosure Act is something that hangs in the balance, it seems. It seemed a few weeks ago that it was dead in the water, that this Schumer-Rounds Amendment wasn't going to go through into the NDAA, and we're not going to get anything like the eminent domain, the Presidential Review Board, all that stuff that I've talked about a lot with Dan. But it seems there may be a chance of something still happening there. And I just wonder, tell me your thoughts on where we're at.
No, I mean, it always never seems to be kind of set in stone, though. So there's always some way around, you know, to get stuff into legislation, I think, in America. I mean, I'm no political expert. As I mentioned on Matt Ford's program, the Good Trouble Show the other week, that, you know, I leave that kind of, you know, the terms of political maneuvering and outmaneuvering to other people to discuss, because I'm not an expert on American affairs. But if it's anything like UK Parliament, and, you know, when something gets battered down because they don't want to put it through, they all usually find a way of doing it in the end anyway. So that's the way I look at this, is that, yes, OK, this time there might have been a temporary setback in terms of, you know, the kind of everything that they wanted, they couldn't get. But as I recall, there's a few things still in there, isn't there? There's at least three things which they've managed to get through. And yeah, one's an audit, and there's a couple of other things. So actually, you have to take that as a bit of a win. And everything else will come when it's ready and when enough people are on board. As I understand, it was either one person or a couple of people who kind of blocked this. So somehow they had enough clout and enough representation to be able to say, look, this is not coming through. Rand Paul, I think, was another one, but there might have been somebody else. It might not have been him. There was definitely a senator or two had kind of, like, you know, pulled the plug on this, if you like. Now, if that's the case, then maybe people have to look into their background and think, well, why are they, you know, so dead against this? Is it because it's a bipartisan issue, as far as I'm aware? I mean, that's my limited knowledge, this whole issue about trying to, you know, get some more answers. So it's not as if it's like the Democratic side or the Republican side pushing this, and the other side are railing against it and trying to kill it. From what I understand, it's somebody who just doesn't think it's a good, you know, it's not good value for money. And now I can understand that argument, because that's something that, you know, people are having around the world in different democracies. You know, we have that argument here about a whole raft of things in the UK. You know, we shouldn't be spending money on this, that, and the other. You know, I can understand why that might be an issue if somebody's not aware of too much about the UAP issue, and they just think, oh, this is just, you know, science fiction or people on tinfoil helmets, why we're shoveling money to this potentially. Then when there's more important things happening around the world from their viewpoint, like hurricane relief, domestic welfare programs, or even supplying Ukraine with money to help them against the Russians. So, you know, you can see where somebody might think money's not being spent wisely. But you have to think, well, okay, but this is maybe more important in terms of what it might, you know, lead to. So, yeah, I think there'll be some way they'll get some of these things back. And I'm not sure how. Say, I'm not an American politics expert, but I think we haven't heard the last of this. And of course, we're going to have the hearings is it November now?
November 13th. Yeah.
Okay. So there's the admiral, isn't it? Tim, and I can't remember. I can't even pronounce his surname.
Tim Gallaudet.
That's it. Yeah. So, and then, do we know anybody else that's appearing? We don't yet, do we?
No, I've seen rumours of Alex Dietrich.
But again, yeah. So have I. But nobody concrete though.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I meant. So who knows who's going to turn up, you know, under oath? Alex Dietrich, great, but we can also do with some other people as well. So I think that's going to give us talking points till Christmas and beyond, isn't it? And then who knows what that leads to? Because, you know, when David Grush and Dave Fravor and Ryan Graves do, you know, we were talking about that for months afterwards, and we still are to some extent. And that galvanized the people who were listening to them to actually to sit up and take notes and think, we need to talk to you in a secure environment, which, you know, didn't happen. And then we've got another set of hearings now. So there's this kind of snowball process. So I think, you know, I don't think this is going to stop anytime soon. So I'm quite positive about it all. I don't feel like it's too much of a setback, not necessarily getting that into the Intelligence Act. I just think it's just a minor kind of little a blip, you know, as we go forward. So yeah, I'm quite positive. I'm not thinking, oh no, it's the end of the world.
Well, Graham, when I have a lack of, you know, up to date progress happening in terms of what's going on in the US with the political UAP situation and whatnot, I've tried more and more the last year or two, particularly, to look back at the history of the topic and things that happened in the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, all the way back. And I think people, when they see those voids and gaps, do enjoy that. And so many folks get in touch with me genuinely who actually care far less about what's happening now, and they do enjoy the history of the topic because for them, they don't need a government to come out and tell them they have permission to believe what they believe. So again, folks could do far worse, Graham, than going and picking up one of your books. A lot of them are free on Kindle, if people have Kindle as well, with memberships. And Graham's now done this documentary, you know, UFOs Before Roswell. It's free on his YouTube channel. If you want 2 hours to go and look at some well-researched content, again, I would point you in that direction. And if nothing else, it may even spark your own, you know, want to go and research and look at, well, okay, that was the 40s, you know, what happened in the 50s, in the 60s and 70s? And I'm sure eventually Graham will get to writing about those years and decades as well. But is that the ultimate plan, Graham?
I mean, I'll probably end up getting the 50s done at least. So there's a good two more books to come out of that. And then who knows where I go on from there. I mean, just as a sidebar, I did write a book about the French UFO wave of autumn 1954 as a kind of passion project. It was a homage to some of the books I read in the 70s and in early 80s, if you like. So, you know, I'm not entirely just like fixed on the pilot and aircrew sightings. That was just something I wanted to do as a, you know, just for me, if you like. So, and I'm quite pleased how that's been received. I was talking to some French guys the other week on one of their shows, and they were, you know, quite pleased that somebody in the English speaking world had taken the trouble to look at that. So I think that kind of thing's important. You know, a lot of the stories that I get out of, from the historical side, is out of foreign language publications, really obscure ones as well, that you just don't have any traction in the English speaking world because they've never been translated. So I think that, to make sure that it's a worldwide phenomenon and people recognize that it's not just something that happens in America, it's not just something that happens in Britain, I think that bit's really important as well, just to point out.
Absolutely. Lovely place to leave it, Graham. Thank you so much again, folks. We arranged this quite last minute. It's been only a couple of hours, and we've put this together for you. Hopefully you've enjoyed this hour of content. Always good to hear from Graham. Make sure you go and subscribe to Bite-Sized UFOs on YouTube. The link's in the description. So is the link to Graham's books on Amazon as well. Those are all, are they all uploaded again, Graham, after the hiccup?
The physical books are the paperbacks. The Kindle, I had a kind of subscription with them in terms of they had to sit on 90 days after I had to pull them. So I think they're still there, but it won't be very long before they're taken off. I've then got to re-upload those without images in, just to keep on the safe side. And then that's it, really. And one day I'll probably end up doing audiobooks, but that's a long way off yet. But there won't be AI. Last thing, we need a physical catch-up sometime.
We do, and we can talk about that, Graham, now off air. Let's keep that behind the curtain. There would be a flock of people, I'm sure, jumping to meet us at our local Starbucks. But Graham, thank you very much, mate. Yeah. Always good talking to you. And speak to you all very, very soon. That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium, YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little more.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. Funny thing about being fast? you end up waiting a lot. First to show up, first in line, then just waiting. Me, I rev up Chumba Casino. With over 200 social casino games, no slow lanes here. Why sit around when you can spin? I'm already racing. Your turn. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. That's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?